Hello, everyone. I'm Tina Barton, Director of the Adelaide Gallery, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome our two speakers today, Jenny McCormick and Terry Galushka, both of them keen astronomers, both of them making important contributions to the field in their respective rights. I'm very pleased to have them here, giving them the opportunity to see and respond to the exhibition Dark Sky. This is actually the third in a series of talks that we've programmed that accompanies the exhibition, where we've been specifically interested in bringing people outside the field of art who are interested in astronomy, scientists, and a range of other academics to interact with the show and give us their perspectives on it. When we were thinking about who to invite to speak and what kinds of topics we should consider, in conversation with Glenda Lewis, who was working for the Royal Society, she said you must not forget the contribution of amateur astronomers to the field of astronomy. And she put forward both Jenny and Terry as very good examples in that category. Of course, when it comes to an exhibition like this, where we have artists exploring the night skies, making photographs by pointing their cameras upwards, in a sense, all of the artists in this exhibition are amateurs when it comes to the subject of astronomy. And perhaps that might be quite a good place to start, to actually ask our two speakers about this term amateur. What does it mean to be an amateur? Is it a term that makes sense in your field, or are all astronomers amateur in some sense?
Well, thank you very much for having us, and or me especially. I've really enjoyed the exhibition, what I've seen so far, and I'm extremely impressed to see such glorious astronomical subjects up on the walls here in the gallery, and I'd love to see this exhibition in Auckland. As for being an amateur, one of the slides I have, if Terry would mind just going back one, I thought about what is an amateur, and for me, as I left school at 15 and did not get any degree, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but so I have no formal education. So astronomy, what I've been doing is been self-taught. And I feel the word amateur. I'm actually doing serious astronomy at the moment and do work with some quite high-powered professionals, providing them very good quality data. But I am an amateur, and I'm seen as an amateur. I don't know if it's quite right. Yes, I'm not being paid to do this, apart from the equipment that is given to me by the universities I work for. They send me overseas as well, free of charge. But I looked up in Wikipedia, what is an amateur astronomer? And as you can see up here, I've popped it up on the wall. We're seen as hobbyists, and I don't see myself as a hobbyist. I don't know about you, Terry, but I don't just go outside with my binoculars and look up into the night sky and go, wow, that's neat, and walk away. Mm-hmm. I do serious astronomical research, and no, I'm not paid for it, but I'm considered an amateur, and I'm not allowed to join our New Zealand, we have a group of professional astronomers, and I'm not allowed to join that group because I'm not, according to this, A, being paid, and I have no academic qualifications.
And yet you built an observatory.
We've got an observatory, yes, and my research, my work is, I feel, what I know is a very high standard, but I'm not allowed to join their group because I'm not a professional. And I wonder, in the art world, is there such a thing as an amateur artist? How does art, how is an artist defined? Is it someone who's, are they a professional artist? What is an artist? that's how I feel about being an amateur, but I go with the term, I'm an amateur astronomer.
Terry, what about you? What's your...
Yeah, very much along the same lines as Jenny. It's certainly, as a child, it was an amateur sort of pastime and hobby. But as I've gotten older, I've taken more of an interest in the research side of things. And I've thrown a considerable amount of money at it. And research protocol into home, and watching do a reasonable amount of research when the weather permits in Wellington. And when it doesn't permit, I am involved in reviewing some of the Kepler data. So in terms of being an amateur, I think it's a very hard thing to define in the field of astronomy, because it's observational based and everybody is able to contribute to a certain level, so it really does become a area of citizen science. And many of the astronomers who are listed here today in our talk, they were amateurs. They didn't necessarily have a formal background, but they were very astute, some of them very good mathematicians, and they really did change our perception of the world and our solar system and the mechanics of it, and help define our place in the universe, I guess. And when you start to branch that out, you then get even into modern times with looking at the things that Hubble did and Hubble's assistants, and you discover that some of his assistants there, they were initially mule drivers who helped to take a lot of the materials up to the Wilson Observatory, but they became very, very skilled astronomers themselves, and helped us discover that we had an expanding universe. So, yeah, very, very hard thing to define.
I think what's interested me in putting this show, working on the exhibition, is that artists and astronomers have some shared concerns. Both the photographers and the scientists are concerned with the business of looking, and looking so carefully and closely, and then trying to find some visual language that is adequate to recording what they see, and then interpreting what they see, and extrapolating from that, and extrapolating conclusions that, in some senses, are very hard to prove. The age of the universe, the distance away, how big it is, how old it is, what's beyond it, and so on and so forth. So there's a degree to which some of what you're dealing with is unknowable. I think that's a kind of nice.
Well, I think the interesting thing, we have to move, looks like it's not moving through, but Horrocks, Jeremiah Horrocks, here's a chap who, a very young man, tutor of mathematics, who predicted the 1639 transit of Venus. Now, he wasn't a professional, he was, this is something he liked doing. And I love the painting here of him looking at the transit, because his prediction was spot on, and he also was able to work out the distance of the Sun to the Earth, which is an astronomical unit of approximately 95 million kilometres, which is pretty amazing considering we know that the distance is 150 million. Yes, he was out by a few, but that's pretty good going. So he's the first astronomer amateur astronomer that I've sort of put up as being pretty amazing. I'm sure there were far more, but this is to do with the transit, the year of the transits, and he is my first amateur at the moment.
So Horrocks, he was very interested in the works of Tycho Brahe and Kepler and Johannes Kepler, and so he went over their calculations and their observations very carefully, and for predicting that transit, he discovered that Kepler had actually made an error in his data, and he recalculated it and realised, hey, it's going to occur, I think it was December 4th, and sure enough, on December 4th, it was right there. And again, this is a man who wasn't, he didn't leave university at the time with completing his degree formally. Went on to tutor mathematics for a family. And, again, it brings into question that whole realm of amateur, professional.
I think back then in the 1600s and earlier, I think the distinction between the two, amateur and professional, wasn't there. I think it was quite, there was sort of, what I've been reading anyway, it's that the distinction of the two just wasn't. They were just all one. the astronomers of the day. Today, of course, it's different. There is the distinction, it's definitely there.
You've got some more images of
early
astronomers.
William Crabtree, he was a friend, of course, of Jeremiah Horrocks. However, in this painting, it's a lovely painting. However, they've actually made Mr. Crabtree look rather elderly in his 70s, but he too was a very young man in his 20s. And just go back to the picture. He was a merchant, and what I like about this painting is that if you look very carefully, you'll see all his bits in his house. He's actually got lots of materials and things all wrapped up in the painting. Can you just move it forward? Just go forward one. Just go, we might have to do it. And can you push it again? If you have a good look, and when you see this painting, you see that he's got material, and it looks like he's actually got a tape measure hanging out of his pocket. Here's his wife there looking at the transit of Venus. I think it's an awesome painting. But what I really liked about what he saw, he wrote about seeing the transit, and he says, wrapped in contemplation, I stood for some time motionless, scarcely trusting my own senses through excess of joy. For we astronomers have, as it were, a womanish disposition and are overjoyed with trifles as to scarcely make an impression on others. So I really love that quote, a womanly disposition. So he too was a pretty clever chap, and he too died young. The next one, we've got another one here. This is just a short selection of New Zealand amateur astronomers, and I've stumbled across a wonderful photograph of 1882 taken in Dunedin by William Rutledge here of the transit of Venus, which that was actually quite difficult. I found that quite tricky to find.
What collection was that?
To be honest with you, I don't know. It was actually in a PowerPoint. A lovely lady gave a talk to the RASNS, the Royal Astronomical Society of New Zealand, about Dunedin astronomy. And this picture here was in her talk. Didn't say where it had come from, it was just that it was taken by William Rutledge. It's a wonderful old photograph. So, I'm afraid I'm not quite sure what collection or where it's come from. Did you want to?
Oh, so I was just going to say, I think in New Zealand we've been very lucky with the sky quality that we've had. That's led to us having some very distinguished amateur astronomers or astronomers and of the category that we're talking about today. One of the names that sort of springs to mind to me is Albert Jones. And I think back in about 2000, Albert finally surpassed 200,000 visual observations of variable stars. And he was doing that with a 10% degree of accuracy. No one else has ever observed and recorded so many variables in that manner. I think in 2004, 2005, Victoria University honoured him with a honorary doctorate for his contribution to science. So the two, as we said, the term amateur, it's hard to find. And as we progress up into a modern time of going from sort of the old photographic plates and now moving into CCD and the availability of such good equipment, the work that we're able to do, even just with a standard camera, can be quite extraordinary.
I have another one. This chap here, not many people know of this man. I know there's no photograph. Samuel J. Lambert. He was a very prolific, high public profile, if you like, in astronomy in the papers in the late 1700s. And he's an interesting chap. He's a professor of music,
And he would literally get people out, people who were well-connected, in fact, of the time, to actually go to observing parties, and especially to observe the transit of Venus, like he did in 1873 here. In fact, I did a little bit of research, because one of the gentlemen that was in this party in 1873 in Hobson Street was a photographer, and that's Mr. Redfern. Now, I was unable to find any photographs of this group. I'm sure Mr. Redfern, the photographer, would have taken photos, and they would be so neat to be able to find photos of this this meeting. He also got a group together in 1882 to observe the transit. Again, the weather was bad in Auckland, but he was a chap that was in all the papers. He was the astronomer who let the public know about what was going on in New Zealand astronomy. But he's not a lot is known about him.
One of the artists in the exhibition, Wolfgang Tillman, who's upstairs, who was a keen astronomer as a child, I tried to encourage him to come to New Zealand to participate in a public program associated with the exhibition, because, of course, we were very fortunate to be able to borrow his work, with the carrot of coming to New Zealand to watch the transit of Venus, imagining exactly that point that New Zealand's skies are very clear, and I knew that there's great little interest in observing it here. But he had already done his sort of meteorological predictions, and said that he had a better chance of seeing the transit in Australia. So he's going to the central desert somewhere to actually watch the transit.
Because
he thinks he's going to see it.
Yeah, because all these teams in 1874 and 1882, they went to a great deal of difficulty to view these events. And New Zealand, it was terrible. They were crowded out everywhere, Burnham and Christchurch, and I think the only place that got a wee glimpse in 1874 was in Queenstown. So that's a lot of money and effort spent in doing this.
And the 1874, or the pair of transits that occurred in the 1800s, that was really like the year of these great exhibitions that you would have scientists going to all parts of the world and trying to capture this data, and a recurring theme through this has been bad weather obscuring the transit, which is just incredible, really, that you could have such bad luck.
What's the weather prediction for Wednesday?
Well, I saw it was good, but then somebody has told me it's not.
Wellington can be not and good on the same day in the same hour.
Goodness me, that's doesn't follow suit. Now, this gentleman here, this is Henry Augustus Severn, and he was from Thames. Now, this chap was very interesting indeed. He lobbied government to have telegraph cables to be put in around Thames, so he could actually time the transit in 1874. Now, he was a very clever man, actually. He was a chemist. He built the telescope that you're looking at there. And not only did he do that, but he also made his own mirror and coated it. So he knew as a chemist how to coat it with silver. So he went to all this trouble, and what happens? Cloud. So it was really, really unfortunate. The British expedition team, you wanted him to be with them in the observations. But again, so mind you, Thames did end up with a telegraph, so I suppose we've got to thank him for that. And the interesting thing is, if you go back over the old papers, paperspast.com or .co.nz, you can read all about what happened, and it's just fascinating. It's a whole exhibition in its own way. But he was interesting, this chap, very clever. And I think there's a picture of his. This gentleman here is John Grigg. Now, this man is amazing. He was a shop owner, a music teacher, and an amateur astronomer. He also was from Thames, but he pioneered astrophotography in New Zealand. Now, I did not know that. And there are lots of his photographs online that I was able to find. And I've got a wonderful picture here showing a comet that he took a photograph called Comet A, 1901. And that's actually taken around Orion the Hunter. And we can, he was very clever. He discovered comets. Apparently the professional Australian professionals thought he was pretty hot, and they did a, there was a lot of correspondence between the professionals and him, Mr. Brook.
So was he just taking that with an ordinary
homemade camera? Yeah, yes. Homemade cameras.
So yeah, that would be one of the very first astrographs.
Yeah,
and you know, if you look closely at the actual image, you see this very little star trail.
Mm.
But you've got this beautifully defined comet and nucleus in there, and the nucleus hasn't really moved much. Whereas if you were to take a long exposure and just keep it still, you'd see that the nucleus would slide as the Earth rotates. And so it would have been a very, very early astrograph. So there would have been a lot of interest in what he was doing. Mm.
So what is an astrograph?
In a sense, a large aperture telescope or camera that tracks the sky.
So it moves.
It moves.
And that means that you don't get those star tracks. Right.
Mm-hmm. So he was actually a very interesting chap. There's a great paper written about this man by Wayne Orchison. And it's all published, and I was fascinated. I had no idea that this chap did what he did, and his photographs are just, well, the time. I mean, really, it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's
he also, too, definitely. Well, actually, definitely, yes.
Yeah, and remember that these were not like a silver nitrate film. You know, these were photographic, very fragile. Glass photographic plates, and to actually get that little bit of starlight onto them was extremely difficult and hard work. So, you know, you'd get astronomers sitting there for, you know, not in this particular place, but in some cases, hours on end trying to capture as many of the photons falling onto the plate as possible. So, and they're out there in the cold, and, you know, they're doing all this manually. So, a real achievement at the time.
Not like we do, we sit in warm offices now.
Luxury.
It's quite interesting, I don't know if I could do what they did.
Do you know where these photographs are now?
The photographs, I actually got them off Papers Pass, I believe, but I have no idea. It was just, I found them, stumbled across them, oh gosh, I'm going to have those. I'm sure they'll be easy to find. Someone will have them in collections. And this is his observatories, as you can see, these were taken, he had two. So he was really into it. I mean, he was two wonderful observatories in Thames. I don't think there's any information about him in Thames. I think there might be an inquiry or seem to find anything. It's a shame, really. Okay, now this is Mr. Ward, Joseph Thomas Ward from Moranui, my hometown. This is where I was born and bred. And I have to say, I didn't know a lot about the observatory as a child. Which is quite weird, really.
Central
Wanganui. Yes, Central. So this gentleman here, he was basically founded by the Wanganui Astronomical Society and the observatory, the Ward Observatory. But his claim to fame is he was into double stars. So he would measure and catalogue double stars for the Southern Hemisphere. And he actually managed to discover 88 new double stars. And these are all in catalogues that anybody can access today. So again, another mirror maker. See, these guys are amazing, really. Mm-hmm. Bookshop owners, farm worker, stationer, and astronomer. Mm-hmm. That's Mr. Ward. Now, this one was interesting. This here is Rix Carlton. Now, he's actually an artist. I found out that he actually, in New Zealand, painted as Rix Carlton, but H.R. Cole, his name is. He was a medical painter, and he would paint medical scenes of deformities. Mm-hmm. And he painted this of Halley's Comet. Now, I've put this in because it's interesting. It's actually incorrect. He's painted the comet. I actually have this. I actually own this painting, watercolour. And he painted the comet in 1910 from Dunedin, but what he got wrong, and I don't get it, was that the angle that we're looking at it at is incorrect. The tail should be the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, he painted in the 50s, which was, so maybe he was trying to remember how it looked, but he got it wrong, so he painted it at the front. And I just love it. It's wonderful when you look at that painting. I just popped that because it was art and it was a strong thing. Sorry about that. Do you want to say anything about Mr. McIntosh?
No, you're doing fine.
just tell me this. Mr. McIntosh, Ronald, reporter, editor, New Zealand Herald. This guy was incredible. I mean, he basically discovered new meteor showers, catalogued them, and we all use them today. He got many awards, we can see here, but a very talented man. Again, called an amateur, says the amateur. Great chap. I often look at, or try to observe some of the meteor showers he discovered. They're quite hard to do, but yeah, so there's not many discoveries of meteor showers left, and he seemed to get quite a few in the southern hemisphere.
And most of the meteor showers that we see today are the result of basically comets having gone past. And as we, in our orbit around the Sun, travel through that debris, that then results in the meteor showers coming through. And if you have a camera out on a monitor, and these are happening just a standard digital SLR that you can do a 30-second exposure or slightly longer, all you need to do is put on a very high ISO, put it straight up at the sky, open it up, and you'll start to catch these streaks radiating. If you're in the right spot, you'll see streaks radiating out from the centre. But all these meteor showers, they are basically the result of previous comet trails that we've travelled through.
There's also, I noticed in some of the exhibition photographs, there's a few meteors in the star trails, which were quite nice to see. They're all around, in fact, yeah, all around us. Little wonderful meteor creatures. Maybe you want to talk about Mr. Bateson. So this is Frank Bateson, again an amateur, a businessman. He actually founded the University of Canterbury's Mount John Observatory. So it was, you know, people who were doing physics and astronomy in New Zealand, they go to Canterbury, and it was because of him that Mount John is there. He also, at 18, believe it or not, founded the Variable Star Section, so for the Southern Hemisphere. And with thousands and thousands of variable star observations, he collected them and sent them to Britain. And so another very clever amateur astronomer, lived to a ripe old age. He did.
Albert.
He's Albert, 500,000 now, active observations.
So what we see here is Albert outside his home with his home book telescope. And he's built that from memory back in the 40s, and continues to use it. And it's now very, very old, but
he still gets out and does variable star observations. So he's basically looking at stars changing their light output, and that's what he's wondering.
And that may not seem significant, but from a scientific aspect, by monitoring the rate at which these stars vary in brightness, it can start to lead information about what the structure of those stars is made up of. So the way they're pulsating, for example, may give us an indication of where they are in their life, their phase, if they've burnt most of their fuel and they're heading towards the end, or in some cases you can have binary stars where you have what's known as a white dwarf circling another star, but it starts to feed off its companion, and it will, for every now and again, have a bit of a hiccup, and it'll eject this material, and we'll see it increase in brightness and then settle down again. And the other part about various variable stars, CFETs from memory, they help in terms of allowing us to calculate the expansion of the universe. So those observations that Albert has made over all those years, painstakingly made, you know, without the aid of any photographic equipment, have contributed to our understanding of the rate of change within the universe, as well as an understanding of the actual structure of stars. So, you know, it's very important from an observational aspect, because there are so few major observatories throughout the world, and with access being limited and time being limited, most professional astronomers often don't get the chance to actually make use or have a lot of time on those telescopes. So when there are so many of us out there with our equipment from home, able to provide them this data, it just becomes invaluable for their research. So we become sort of their eyes, and they can then collate it, and with the use of computers today, feed it all into a database, and a very large database, and sift through what they need. So
Albert too was given an honorary doctorate from Waikato University, I think, from memory. But amazing chap. Discovered comets as well. And a supernova, co-discovered an exploding star.
And that was supernova 1987A, which was, I think, one of the brightest supernovae that we've seen in our lifetime. Very visible in an area called the Tarantula Nebula. And I mean, I remember that in my as a child, looking up and wondering, oh, what's that? And probably being, you know, amongst a handful of people to have seen that, you know, it's just amazing, really. It's something I'll never ever actually forget. So, yeah.
Another record that Albert holds is the one for the longest time between two subsequent discoveries of comets.
Yes,
over 50 years.
That's right.
It's remarkable. So, yeah. As a young man, he discovered one,
and
he's
never
the next one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You'll probably still find comets today, aren't you? And you, I'm sure you all know this, being Wellingtonians, that this is Peter Reed, and again, another amateur astronomer and artist, and I quite like his work. I think his are quite lovely. Very clever man.
Santa Clara Observatory.
Yes. A lot of some of the pictures that the paintings the Auckland Astronomical Society have, where I'm from, have given to Carter to actually show those paintings. Is it actually still going, is it?
They're in the back room. There are a couple on display in the galleries, but there's a whole stack of them in there.
They had a wonderful display up there of Peter Reed memorabilia, and his artwork was just great to sort of look at, because he captured a time which was a real great exploration. You know, he was NASA and the space race and the Soviets and who was going to get to the moon first, and you know, you saw all these little badges that from the Apollo missions and trinkets like astronaut food and these little tubes, and you know, it was quite great to sort of go along and see. Also, one of the Peter Reed telescopes was in use until about 18 months ago by one of the local astronomical societies. It was a 9-inch refractor, and that formed part of the exhibition. They cleaned it all up, brought it back to clean brass, and it was up there. So.
Yeah, he didn't only paint sort of like futuristic works. He also painted, he would observe Venus and Mars and actually paint what he was seeing, even though he wasn't taking photographs. So his work was in the detail of looking through the telescope and painting what he saw. And we've got some wonderful, we gave online a wonderful couple of images, paintings of Venus, showing in detail, and it was really amazing. It was very clever, and of course he popularised astronomy as what, you know, was really neat about him, and his night sky show.
Yeah. You know, and he had this wonderful observatory in his backyard there. I think he was in Seaton or around that way in Wellington, and it was a very odd shaped sort of building. It was round, but had sort of a flattish roof and two shutters, and allowed him to use a very large refractor straight from his home there. So he very much popularised astronomy in New Zealand and brought it to the masses, which no doubt would have inspired, you know, the next generation of astronomers.
Well, people still talk about it today. Oh, I remember seeing them on TV. So, almost. And then, of course, Dr. Mark Christie, I can't leave him out, another amateur astronomer, but a bioengineer on heart valves. But he's worked with me discovering planets. We work in a collaboration for Ohio State University. And what's good about what Grant and I do, and what's important, is that we have small telescopes, but the small telescopes can get on targets really quickly compared to the big 2-3 meter telescopes. So we can get on, we can do work that others can't. We haven't anybody saying you've got to, pay for the use of our telescopes. So we get on and do quite important work when others aren't, and get confirmation of planets, and we've been quite lucky. But Grant also takes lots of photographs of the night sky, and this is one of the comet he took. I forgot the name.
Which year was that? Was that before Christmas?
No, that was a couple of years ago. I've forgotten.
McNaught.
Yeah. And so Grant's very heavily involved in research, in running the Auckland Observatory. Started
an
observatory research team.
But the comets have such a distinctive look that you can recognise them from the photograph, or you just know the time.
Yes, no, you recognise them.
Yeah.
So it's a spectacular one.
The trail of the leaders, distinctive or something.
There were hundreds of people down at the south coast in Wellington trying to look and see it. Yeah. And it was obvious in the sky.
Unfortunately, in Auckland, it wasn't that, although this was taken from One Tree Hill, and you can see the light pollution there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But photograph was able to bring it out, but it was very hard to see.
I remember also here, it was a difficult photograph, but easy to see.
Yeah.
But there were forest fires in Australia at the time, so the sky was red.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we were sort of in cloud, and it was a bit miserable, but he managed to do it, which was neat.
In Wellington, McNaught was just absolutely spectacular. It's known as a horse's mane comet. And so what happens is it comes around in this great big sweeping arc, and you get this trail and tail of this coming through. And from the south coast of Wellington, when it hit its peak, it was just a sight to behold. It was so large that even after, the nucleus, the front part, had set, there was this massive tail up into the sky, about 30 degrees up into the sky, and it really was quite something to see. But they come around fairly often, comets like that, so, and they're always a great sign.
Can I ask, why hasn't Hubble put people like you out of business? Why are Earthbound telescopes still important?
Hubble at the time, it was from the time it was conceived to the time that it was launched in full production there, it was nearly a 40-year project.
Yeah.
And the funding that's required to actually get it there, and the technology to catch up with it was...
But now that it's up there, surely they're sending back digital data.
They are. What we're dealing with Hubble now is 1980s technology compared to it's had a few upgrades, which is great, but then Earth-based telescopes like Keck and the Very Large Telescope Array in Chile, and some of the other ones, binocular telescope in Arizona, with the adaptive optics units that they now use, their resolution and resolving power is actually better than Hubble.
The thing with those type of telescopes and Hubble, universities are paying money to actually, hey, I've got this target I want to look at, and they're on a waiting list. So It's, you know, basically a waiting list and money. Whereas people like myself and Stu Parker here from Christchurch, we don't have that. You know, we're told, Jenny, we need you, or Stu, we need you to check this object out. No problem. So we don't have, we're not restricted in that way. So like this chap here, Stu Parker, 26 supernova discoveries since he's been going. And he's a young man, young farmer, very important. One of his discoveries was incredibly important recently. And it was 2011, I think it was four.
Yep.
And I mean, basically, this is a very bright, close, exploding star. And this type of supernova are able to work out the distances in the universe and the expansion of the universe. So, yeah, he doesn't have anyone telling him, no, I don't want you to look at that, I want you to do this. He can just go out and do the work when he wants
to. The other thing as well is that with the light vehicle appears, you've got Stuart, and he's leaning against what is a robotic telescope now. I have the same mount at home, and you can program these things and say, right, I want to run a search program of 400 or 500 stars or galaxies for an evening, and it's all automated. You fire it off, you walk away, you don't even have to go back and look at anything, barring perhaps an accidental cable tie-up, which you hope you've sorted out well in advance. That will just roll away with the camera and ring. but it'll just do its thing, and then you come back in the morning and then to do the discovery work, you have another program that will just race through the images looking for differences between the images, so you're no longer in a state of having to visually blink, and because you're not restricted by someone else's requirements, you just get on and do it. And
doesn't that take the thrill?
I'd agree that to an extent, I think, when you start to remove yourself from that process. I still love getting behind the eyepiece of the telescope and making a visual connection with the likes of a planet or a star. You know, the photons are either being reflected off of it and or being transmitted from it, and sort of like a piece of that off shed. And whereas in that scenario there, you're removed from it, you're not sort of doing classical observing.
So in that scenario, what you're actually looking at is a computer screen.
That's
visualized data.
I can't go to bed and leave my telescope operational and just leave it. I can't. I have to, which is quite difficult for work in the morning, but there's nothing like, you know, actually watching your data coming off the telescope, knowing that what you're doing is making a contribution to the science that you love. And I just watch it, and wide-eyed, coffee, biscuit, until dawn, if necessary. But I couldn't do that. I just couldn't.
I'll just make a quick comment. Question about the large telescopes. A lot of those large telescopes are looking at a very tiny piece of the night sky. Whereas a lot of amateur astronomers are scattered around the world with their telescopes, and they can cover the whole night sky. So they discover things that a lot of the research telescopes won't even see.
I mean, a real poignant moment for amateurs was the, well, semi-professional, I suppose, was Shumanka-Levy 9. The comet that David Levy discovered, and they looked at it and thought, that's really strange, what is this object? Because what they could see was this bright, like it's a string or a line of light. It's like, what's going on there? And of course what it turned out to be was a comet that was coming into our solar system from way, way out in the Oort cloud somewhere, and it had been captured by Jupiter. And the gravitational field of Jupiter had just ripped it apart as it got closer and closer, and then it hit. And astronomers around the world were waiting, you know, with absolute anticipation to see what happened, because it was like, you know, hey, how did the dinosaurs die? And we know it was a great big sort of catastrophe, but how big is this going to be on Jupiter? And then when that piece hit, and the explosion was on multitudes of times larger than anyone had ever anticipated, it was a real wow moment that, hey, this is a real extinction event, you know, that it's just going to obliterate everything. How could a snowball from outer space do so much damage?
I think another thing with amateur astronomers, what we've, I think, shown the professionals is that
we're good to work with, and we're cheap to work with as well. And we supply really good data. So we've proved that the small telescope, like the one I'm using, a 35-centimetre, 14-inch, we're talking about the mirror size here, is a very useful piece of equipment. They use us a lot now because they know that we can do the work. We might be small, but we can do the work. And we do it well.
And that is the thing, is that the quality of the equipment is so good today. We really do live in a golden age of technology and not too much light pollution, that we can still perform very, very useful tasks and gather really good data. So even going back 100 years or 200 years when it was still not really a profession per se, we're still making discoveries. We're still breaking new ground and contributing to the science of astronomy. So.
What did you think of the Trevor Paglen project? I don't know if I had a chance to see it in a lot of the gallery. Did you have a look at that
one? Oh, the wonderful pictures.
The one with military satellites.
Oh, amazing.
They're all taken by amateur photographers like yourselves.
Yeah.
Using, I suspect, equipment like what you described, where they had to be driven by software that could actually track these things through the sky.
Not necessarily. They could have used, I'm not quite sure how that person took those photos, but
they were taken by a whole bunch of amateur astronomers.
Oh, okay, that's probably
true. They were harnessed on this project by the artist.
Right, oh, I see, right. Yeah,
using apparently software that they developed to track military classified satellites through the sky and photograph. So unreal. Thank you.
Yeah, very clever.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, I mean, I'm interested in how connections are made, as you're saying, for example, that amateur astronomers all over the world will be watching the disintegration of their comet or something.
Well, we have really good...
How do you connect with each other?
We have really good forums that we signed up to.
Yeah.
And then there's different programs of work run by various universities. Jenny's involved with work from the Ohio State University.
My own Columbia University. We all email. It's all done either by tweeting, texting.
I've been doing some work with Cornell University. With the Kepler data.
And so in a sense there's a huge network of people like yourselves around the world.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And these organizations, professional centres say, hey, we could really do with some spotting of this phenomenon.
Yes. Yeah. So Kepler data, for example, that comes into Cornell, they look at it, it's too much data for them to deal with. They put it out there. Virtually anybody can sign up to it.
Yeah.
And then you go through, have a check of it, and you'll look at the variables or transit events and relay that data back to them, and then if you get a suspected target, they'll notify you, and then it's followed up with big ground-based telescopes. If you're lucky enough, you're either an author or a contributor to that particular exoplanet find.
Yeah, with the work that I do in looking for planets, Canterbury, there's the big MOA telescope at Mount John, and their job is to survey the sky. So they survey the Milky Way, like this picture, wonderful picture here that Terry's got up on the screen, and they're looking for stars that could possibly show us planets. So once they survey and they find some interesting target, they will then send an email out to the different universities that we work with. That then all of a sudden, without, you know, you get texts, it's all on. You know, everyone get onto this target, have a look at it. So everyone's watching, and when you're into this...
Can I just ask, so the tweeting speed matters because of the authoring thing, like because the first person to...
No, it's just a way of sort of getting in touch with the people that are doing the work, like myself and Grant and the others around the world. So it's not so much speed, it's more, it is speed if you... Yeah, I suppose
Lee Johnson in the gallery
tried
to photograph Sputnik in order to be the first to have his photograph reproduced in life, which he was. He actually took the first, but he couldn't get it to life in time. So I'm wondering if you're in the same situation.
It depends on what the target is, what the target's doing. If it's really important, we've got to be on, and they'll tell us. The professionals will go, look, Jenny, this is. You've got to get onto it right now.
Sure. I was assuming, because we're talking about time, you know, extended into eons.
Yeah.
The speed that shouldn't matter. Like, if you're seeing a comet that's going to crash into Jupiter, you can see it for months, couldn't you? Well, why does it matter to do it now?
Yeah, with what we do looking for planets, the time scale can be over hours or it can be over days.
So why is that?
It's
visibility shifts or something?
Yeah, it depends on, on the alignment of the stars that we're looking at. So the professionals with their computer programs, they will let us know if the event is unfolding
so
in a few minutes.
It's just a little window of opportunity.
A window of opportunity. Yeah. Sometimes, as I said, there's days, and they look at the analysis of the object, and they'll work out, hey, look, do it now. And so you just do anyway. Even if they say don't, you just get on and it's exciting.
So with the work that Jenny's doing, it's the microlensing.
Yeah.
So gravitational microlensing. So the event, you do have a time frame in which to view it, and you are constrained by that. With the data which I'm involved in reviewing with Kepler, the data's been captured. So it's no big deal. You can review it whenever, but you're just going to get a big backlog of data. And that data is identical to the transit of Venus. Basically, you have a silhouetted disk going in front of the star, and the amount of light that you're seeing dips. And so you can either see it live and capture it, or you can review somebody else's data. So if you're clear about it, why don't you just jump on the net, download the next load of data, and get working with it. So
yeah. Ours all depends on alignment of me, like the stars I'm looking at, and they are only staying in alignment for a short time.
Right.
Once they've shifted, that's it, it's over. You'll never see it again.
And you're also both photographers, though? Okay. Photography is part of what you do as astronomers?
To be honest, I don't. Well, yes, no, I do. I take photos. The equipment I use is a CCD camera, a charge coupled device. And it will take photos of stars. So I take star images.
Is that custom built to be attached to a telescope?
It is indeed, yes. So it's all attached to the telescope, and all that's and attached to the computer. And I download the picture. So yes, I do take astrophotography pictures of stars. But I don't do this type of thing. It's just on a star field. I just take pictures of stars.
So
thousands of them. Basically,
just
little dots.
So, the astrophotography part, I mean, that's probably not such a... You might be able to see it there. But that there is...
A camera attached to the back of the telescope, basically.
Well, in that case, the front of the telescope.
Astronomy today, the type of work we do, you're not looking through an eyepiece anymore.
Yeah.
So you're not sort of sitting in your observatory going, oh, yes, okay, it's not like that.
So, and that's a specific astronomy camera. But for that photo there that I took there, that was just a standard DSLR on tripod, 30-second exposure out on Carterton. And you just get, and although it's not rotated optimally, but the actual full image, if you were to see it, it's been cut off a bit at the top, you're just seeing the galactic centre. So that big dark vein coming up through to the Coalsack and the Southern Cross, and you've got the two pointers there at the Southern Cross, pointing to the Southern Cross near the top there. And then you've got the galactic center back in here, and of course that big area there is what the Aborigines refer to as the EME.
It's an arm of our Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah, you know, and that's a very simple pursuit. When you look at some of the photographs that have been done here on the Gelton plates and so forth, the amount of effort that went into producing those compared to this was just phenomenal.
So do you find it disturbing to be surrounded by artists who distort the accuracy? They're not interested in accuracy, they're interested in other things.
No, I think that's also not at all. I just love looking at it.
You know, even some of the images I have here, like that one there, that's of a globular cluster. So let's just take them from home. It's pretty
simple. We'll test these guys and see what they ID and what they can.
And, but, you know, from a or perhaps that one there, and that's the sun. And that's in blue. Now it's in blue because it's taken in a wavelength known as calcium K. And the K-line filter basically allows you to see a lot of structure around the sunspots. But the interesting thing there, the connection that I have to that, is it's a reminder that the calcium in my bones is from the stars. The iron in my blood is from the stars. And, you know, that's kind of my connection when I look up there. It's just that in wonder and awe of how this all came together to form us.
The picture you have, the next one of yours, of the sun, and what I like about this picture here of the sun, our star, is basically just like when you look at all these wonderful photographs, they're all stars, and they all look like that. Some big, some small. That's it. Yeah. That's what they all are on these wonderful images.
I've got one last question, because something that struck me about the Tillman pictures, which I don't really understand, maybe you can explain, is why the sun is so perfectly circular. Because I always imagined it was this flaming mass, that the edges of it, if you like, would always be not regular, not circular.
I guess like in that image there, you don't really get to see any flaming mass around the outside.
No. Why is that?
Okay. It's to do with the telescope that I was using. So in Tillman's case, he was using what's known as a white light filter. So it blocks just about every single wavelength visible. And there's a tiny little part of the spectrum through, which then produces white light. So you don't actually get to see the flares and the prominences that are coming off the surface of it. You don't get to see the detail. To get down to the detail, you need to then block all the other wavelengths to allow just hydrogen alpha at a certain wavelength of about between 0.5, 0.8.
So it sounds like the technology itself, in effect, abstracts what we see. This isn't actually where the sun is, it's a kind of abstraction of it.
That is exactly what the sun looks like.
But I thought it has flame shooting off.
It does, but if I change the etalon back on the telescope, I will get to see the flares as opposed to the surface detail.
So in effect, what you're doing is focusing and looking through the vaporous flames of the surface.
Well, if you look closely on this image here, you can actually see some of those that you're questioning about.
The filaments.
The filament there. Now, if we were to see this on the side, you would see it coming around like this.
Obviously, so it's actually like three-dimensional.
Yes.
Yeah. But remember, the sun is such a massive sphere and has such depth that to capture all of that, I've got to get it to a certain focal point and wavelength to get it correct. Mm-hmm. And it's so, so fine that I can't capture all of it. So one of the ways for me to have done, this was a labor of love. This took over 2 weeks. Okay. So the images were all taken one day, and it took me over 2 weeks, literally, of processing about 13,000 images and stitching it all together in about 30 panels to produce this image.
So it's a kind of composite.
Mm. Oh, very, very much so. Now, had I taken another big stack of images, I could have put the flares around the outside that would be visible on the day. But certainly that there is a major filament through the sun there. There's another one coming through there. There's one there. Right in the top right corner there, there's one or two more. And then you can see all the detail around the sunspots and the magnetic field lines and how they're twisting the surface of the sun. So,
I can go teach. It's very sad. That's how you do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So yeah, I mean, and all this is available to, you and I today, the technology to allow that. Whereas if you look at Tillman's work, it comes back to sort of him using what he had, I guess, as a child and his interest in astronomy, and he got the white light filter and he put it on the scope, and the transit of Venus was around, and that obviously spurred that boyhood interest in wanting to capture an image of it, and he got out there and caught this beautifully defined circular image with this highly contrasting black dot, perfect little sphere on a large white sphere. You know, and
if you look, the cloud. I love the cloud.
And some of the cloud. And if you look at some of Tillman's other work, you realise that, you know, that it's actually really in keeping with a lot of the contemporary style of his work from the late 80s and 90s, where you'll see images of, say, a folded piece of cardboard, and there's this very defined edge of the cardboard and deep blackness underneath of the underside of the paper, but then this brilliant white around it. And the image itself doesn't necessarily say much, but it's those very well-defined lines. And I guess that is portrayed in his images there of the transits.
Timothy, you were telling me before that you actually had encountered his work as a schoolboy.
I was very fortunate. I had an art teacher by the name of Noel Ferriat at St. Bernard's College, Lyon Hunt. And Noel was a really, really keen photographer, and he sort of encouraged my interest in photography. And it wasn't until this exhibition, when I was doing a little bit of study, that I basically stumbled across some of the works that we'd seen that Noel had shown us. And it was quite sort of captivating, because my wife, Catherine, sort of said to us, well, we're having a discussion about dark skies and what to say about Tillman and so forth. And I was like, yeah, I don't really see it. And Catherine goes, no, I don't see it either. Boyhood interest in astronomy, artist, astrophotography. Yeah, I really don't see the connection between you and him at all. It was quite a moment to sort of realise, I've seen his work. And, having a tutor like Noel to actually foster that interest in cameras, and having his old, at the time, called just cheap, nasty little box cameras, of course, but they turned out to be Hasselblads. But as a student and a young person, you don't really appreciate that. So you get out there, get involved in the dark room, and you take, depending on what you're studying at the time, I was studying Picasso and Cubism, so you're able to roll the film back over itself and do multiple exposures over one shot, and you build these cubism type images of a person in the portrait. And you know, then to sort of have a week where you spent a little bit of time just touched swiping on Tillman's it's quite an experience to then be sort of invited back to a gallery to exhibition on his work. So that's quite interesting.
Really nice, yeah. We've run out of time, but I'm just wondering, do you have a burning question that you'd like to ask about the Jenny and Terry? Thank you.
I don't know anything about astronomy, but is the transit viewable to the naked eye?
It is, but you don't want to view it with your naked eye. It's very dangerous. You can get little viewers. I'm sure you can get them from the Carter Observatory. Yeah, and they're very safe. You can pop them up and you can have a look. So it's on the 6th of June, from 10:30 it starts until 4:40.
10:15,
is it? Right, okay. So yeah, get out. But wait till the sun's a little higher. It's not going to get too high because unfortunately we're coming into winter. But get out and definitely have a look and try to take a photograph of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the Carter, I'm sure they've got the solar telescopes operating.
And to just on that note also, Jeffrey Becton, who is with Tapsman here, who is the co-curator of this show with Christina, is doing a talk on the day of the transit with William Tillman.
Oh, fantastic.
So that will be a really interesting talk, and after the talk we've got a bunch of equipment.
Oh, you do
guys
are
so
good.
And so we'll be
really
fantastic. So we can go outside and view it. We'd love to meet it.
With
him.
Oh, yes, let's all pick up. Yeah. If not, I'm sure we'll be able to watch it live online. Telescope will have it's not the same level.
But in case you get clouded out, and we are sort of all hoping for clear skies. There's going to be some great websites that will be streaming it live. It is a once in a lifetime event, and we're not going to see this.
Is everyone alive today or be dead? When the next one occurs?
Most likely.
2117.
So do go out there and make an effort. and it does have a beautiful connections to history with, you know, Cook going to Tahiti, recording it, and then coming down to sort of, he was doing the circumnavigation of the globe and, you know, wanting to find that great southern land which was meant to have balanced out the world from the northern hemisphere, and, you know, coming through and discovering, for want of another term, New Zealand, and then his encounter with the indigenous population. And so, you know, there's a lot of events around that, so it's a great connection to New Zealand.
And I'll be thinking about those amateur astronomers in 1873 who were all just dying to see it, and it was cloudy. So I'll be thinking about it. Yeah.
But certainly the solar viewers are available through Resonance and Carter Observatory for about $2, and very worthwhile getting hold of the pair so that you can see it. If you can't get hold of a pair of those,
you could use a pair of binoculars.
Yeah.
You can
project.
You don't look up at the sun. You actually cover one of the lenses with some paper.
Yeah.
And you'd have to have it on a tripod or something. And sort of like aim it at the sun, and then you'll have the images of the sun come out onto a whiteboard behind you. Yeah. Just remember again, never look up. Never.
But that would be the other option. Don't be tempted to try to get hold of a little pair of green welding goggles. They're gas welding. They will let too much light through. They will damage your eyes. If you are able to get a proper full welding mask, and it would have to be a full welding mask, not the goggles.
They might have something here at the
you know, there might be in one of the labs there, yeah. And the machinist might have something that's suitable like that, but it needs to be a grade 10 filter in there. And for anybody who's doing arc welding or MIG welding, that would be a suitable lens, because when you consider that arc, the metal arc that's produced is many, many times brighter than the sun, and that would be the only other safe way of viewing it, and they're about $10 to buy if Resonance may have run out. But we do not be tempted to get the little green pair of goggles. My wife and I watched a partial solar eclipse last year from the wind turbine, and some guys turned up there and they had these green goggles wanting to look directly at the sun. And I had the solar scopes up there and so forth, and I sort of had to advise them not to, and then we got them behind the telescopes to have a look, and the wow factor hit them, you know, being able to see an image like that of the sun and then seeing the moon just start to partially cover it. Do not be tempted on the green goggles.
Thank you all for coming. It's been the most enlightening and interesting talk today. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you both for coming. I'm sure you'll be looking forward to next week.
Definitely.
And thank you all.
Thank you.
So we'll see you again.